to remember why we're focused on masculinity and femininity and marriage within the context of a Lent retreat, because Lent is meant to facilitate our being renewed in the image of God, to become more and more like God, yoked to the Lord from the inside out. And insofar as He has created us in His image and likeness, if we're going to be truly yoked in life, we need to be fully human in order for Him who took on our humanity to give us a share of His divinity. And so that's what we're seeking to do in these talks. I try to keep it more and more sort of prayerful and beautiful rather than what I typically give as a conference, so that we're able to receive this differently than we would if we were in a lecture hall, for example. But to receive it on a heart that's silent, that's appreciative of God's wisdom, and is able to look more deeply into the things as they are. Last time, we mentioned the culture in which we are, in which there is a conceptual attack, and not just a political one, on masculinity, femininity, marriage, family, human sexuality, what love means, etc. And this isn't just a question of whether we're going to hurt somebody's feelings. None of us wants to hurt somebody's feelings. But it's a question about the real direction of where we're going in. This is, in a sense, blowing up roads. And if we destroy the infrastructure of a society, for example, it's very difficult to communicate or to move in the right direction or the wrong direction. And at a conceptual, at an anthropological level, what's been happening in the last 50 years at its largest, but then in a more narrow phase in the last 20, 25 years, has been a bombing of the anthropological and ethical infrastructure that people need to know the truth and to live by the truth. That's why it's so key for us to recognize this as part of the gospel. You know, there's that famous passage in St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, likewise in the Romans, where he says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, because he knows it's the power of God. He wasn't ashamed of the cross. There's going to be some suffering involved. He wasn't ashamed of the things that went contrary to the politically correct ideas of the age. And there were many in Christianity. You see that, for example, in Athens, where Paul was, well, we'll listen to you later. We don't have time for you now. But today, in the midst of a world in which if we support pro-life activities, we're treated as misogynists. If we support marriage as the institution between one man and one woman, we're labeled homophobic. If we want bathrooms so that little girls don't have to worry about big guys in their own bathrooms and everything else like this, we're labeled as insensitive. We can't be ashamed of the gospel. We have to be willing and confident that the truth is here. And because of this, pass on the truth with charity. Not the truth as a weapon, but it's the truth as the means really to liberation. And that's why this is part of a retreat. I have to say that because the culture is with so many, especially of young people today, the culture is much more heard than the gospel. It's much more influential. And so if we could hurt somebody's feelings on the one hand, who might be transgender, or hurt God's feelings on the other, we're much more concerned about the transgender than we are of God. And if we're really concerned about the transgender's feelings, we've got to increase the scope. Not just for this world, not just for the emotivism of the age, but for the much larger questions. We want everybody to come to know the Lord, to find joy in Him who came into our world, to plant His joy within us, and to bring them to eternity. And these questions are of huge stakes. So let's get to the feminine genius. Christ reveals man fully to himself and makes his supreme calling clear. And the human person can only find himself in the disinterest, the unselfish gift of himself toward the other. That's true for men. It's likewise true for women. And as we talked about last time, there were two basic pivots First is the virginal meaning of human existence, that we're first and foremost a gift to God, and in that self-giving to God who gives himself to us first, we learn how to give to others. And then it's going to be the full flourishing of the iconic feminine genius in motherhood, physical and or spiritual. So we're going to spend most of our time there. I do want to start with something that's often out there with regard to the church's approach to women. Women have clearly suffered because of chauvinism and misogyny for millennia. Jesus came at a specific time, and Jesus, compared to both the Roman culture and the Jewish culture, was revolutionary in the treatment of women. It was unheard of that Jesus would talk, that any Jewish man would talk to any one who was not his wife at midday at a well, as we heard 2 weeks ago. Yet Jesus did it. When the apostles came back, they were shocked! Shocked that Jesus was talking to a woman alone in a well. He was affirming her dignity and leading her to the true spouse after she had gone through 5 and was living with someone who was not her spouse. Jesus was revealing himself ultimately as the bridegroom to her. Women didn't have any status at all to testify. And the apostle to the apostles was a woman. Mary Magdalene was the first one who received the good news that Jesus had triumphed from the dead. He was establishing women in society. Jesus himself defended women's dignity, as we see in the woman caught in adultery. Jesus went out of his way to say, let the one who was without sin be the first to cast a stone. He was saving her life in that circumstance. Even a woman who had made some choices that Jesus wouldn't approve of. He was defending her dignity to the end. And there at the cross, Jesus was clearly affirming the extraordinary strength of women. Didn't call Mary Mama, called her woman, because there was a reconstitution going on. While most of the apostles had fled out of cowardice, they had 3 women standing. Stabat Mater, I just love that verb. She wasn't fainting or swooning. She was standing. As the son whom she used to bathe was bathed in blood, as the hands that used to grip her finger were nailed to wood, as the feet that used to scamper across dusty pathways to jump into her arms were immobile. She was there, standing. As we were being burned, that unlike the first childbirth with Jesus, where it was painless, the church has always taught dogmatically, the second one was very painful. It happened on Calvary, as she was given to us as our mother by the son whose father had chosen her to be his own one, spiritually. So she's got so much to teach us, as do the women in sacred scripture. I'm so happy to know that here at Old St. Patrick's there is this feminine genius, Lectio Divina, that's happening. I just encourage as many as possible to participate in this, not just for your own sake and your own spiritual growth, but also so that you can so interiorize what you're learning that you can breastfeed many others with what you have digested. Jesus' respect for women, John Paul II said, caused others to marvel. When he met with that woman who bathed his feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair, the Pharisees in the house said, if this man really were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, for she is a sinner. But Christ defended her as well, that she would enter the kingdom far before the others. Jesus defended women against the harm of divorce, because the Mosaic law was such, because of the hardness of their heart, that a man could divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever. She made a bad meal. I'm sorry, I mean, we've actually got historical records of that. Made a bad meal. All it just says, you are no longer my wife. And that was it. It. Over. She couldn't do it in the reverse. She had no stability, therefore. Jesus was defending women. Jesus' teaching, as well as in his behavior,
One can find nothing that reflects the discrimination against women prevalent on his day. On the contrary, his words and works always express the respect and honor due to women. Now, why do people think that Jesus might be misogynist?
No, there were many women disciples, but no women who were apostles, right? That's the reason. And let's confront that straight on. Jesus was constantly going past the prejudice of his day, both Roman, which had priestesses, as well as Jewish. And when he celebrated the Last Supper, there was zero evidence that there was a woman there when Jesus was ordaining the first priest. Now for us, as we look with faith at this, the very fact that he didn't do something isn't a clincher of evidence. It doesn't mean that he couldn't have done something. He could have theoretically done something. But for us with faith, we've got to look at some of the assumptions. Assumption number one. Was Jesus a coward to circumvene the Jewish cultural idea against women's priestesses? I think it would be very difficult for us to say that Jesus wouldn't have bucked cultural prejudices to do what was right. It would be inconsistent with our faith. Second, would Jesus just not have known what was really happening? Can we say that we know better than Jesus? That if we were back there and we could have advised, she said, Jesus, we need some women to be priests because we can't find the men, or men aren't committing, or whatever the reason would be. Are we going to basically say that Jesus was short-sighted? Again, it's a very, very difficult thing for us to argue if we're saying he is the God-man and wisdom in the flesh. Third aspect of this, third assumption that would be behind a claim like that, is that Jesus really was a misogynist. That he really didn't believe in the equality of men and women, despite all the rest that he was doing. And that, again, is an assumption contrary to everything else we know and we believe about Jesus. For us to take Jesus seriously means that we believe, even if he didn't tell us, that what he did for a reason, and the reason was a good reason. Wasn't a bad reason, but that he acted intentionally with good motivation. It's got to be an assumption. Now, from a theological point of view, what does the church fundamentally say about this? That a priest is ordained in the person of Christ, the bridegroom of the church. Just as men can't get pregnant, women can't be bridegroom, they can't be husbands. Many times, and this is another thing about sort of the gender issues today, is when we don't take masculinity and femininity seriously, paternity and maternity seriously, then it makes no sense. It just seems like an irrational discrimination and that glass ceiling has got to come crashing down. But when we begin to take these things seriously and we begin to look at what Jesus was calling his apostles to be in the image of him, the bridegroom of the church, we begin to get a little bit more of a mysterious perception of what he was doing. For me, as I do a lot of theology on taps, every question that you always wanted to ask a priest but never had the chance, or whatever you want to call it in a given night, these questions come forward often. In one of the things that a priest needs to say in response is, that a priest is not supposed to be a lord. A priest is a glorified foot washer. And the first priests were all signing up to be martyred. And with all due respect for President Obama and everybody else, as a man, I am offended that women are going to be dying on the front lines in combat. Should women be in the military? Absolutely. Let's bring the genius of women into the military. Peacemakers, we absolutely need women to dominate peacemaking. But as a guy and as a spiritual dad, I would never want my daughter fighting against ISIS. I just want to protect them from that. They can serve in other ways. And in a similar way, we could say that it would be fitting, at least, that Jesus was putting his men out there to be martyred. He wasn't going to be voluntary, the ones that he wanted the men to learn how to protect if he needed to overcome selfishness. But that's fundamentally the reason this question of women's ordination, in which people reading back into Jesus' time don't always appreciate just how revolutionary he was in affirming woman's dignity.
Let's look at the two dimensions of woman's vocation. I'm going to start with motherhood. Motherhood shows, in a classic sense, one of the aspects of feminine genius, which is that woman is made by God already with space for another. It's very mysterious. Woman's created by God with space for another. And that overflows, in general, to an attitude toward other human beings. Not only to the children who will inhabit that interior space, but to every human being. And this openness toward other human beings profoundly marks a woman's personality. It's commonly noted, and it's true, that women are more capable of men than paying attention to other persons. And motherhood develops this predisposition ever more. Women are far more emotionally intelligent than men, on average. They've got a far greater capacity for relationality than men, on average. And this isn't coincidental. It's ontological. St. John Paul II says, a man, even with all his shearing and parenthood, always remains outside of the process of pregnancy and the baby's birth. In many ways, he has to learn his own fatherhood from the mother. He's got to learn a little bit about parenthood from the mother's wife. One can say that this is part of the normal human dimension of parenthood, including the stages that follow the birth of the baby, especially the initial period. The child's upbringing taking as a whole should include the contribution of both parents, the maternal and paternal. But the mother's contribution is more decisive in laying the foundations of the new human personality. And this overflows into the way the woman relates to the entire world. The second pillar of feminine genius is virginity for the sake of the kingdom. Again, this virginal meaning doesn't refer to intact parts of the woman's body. It fundamentally involves this nuptial gift given first and wholeheartedly to God. When I was in seminary and a baby priest, there was a chastity speaker who was very effective and overall extraordinarily good. His name was Molly Kelly. And she was a real popularizer of the term secondary virginity. I know precisely what she was trying to articulate, that if you've already lost your virginity, in a sense, pack up your self-gift again, save it for your future spouse, etc. Give of yourself anew. Beautiful idea behind it that I support. But it was still a notion of virginity that I think was a little bit too physical and not enough personal. John Paul II's, his whole idea of virginity is first and foremost a gift of oneself wholeheartedly to God. And so somebody who had been trafficked for 15 years, somebody who was a prostitute for 30, could, after a massive conversion, give herself virginally over to God. And in that, analogously, give herself anew to a husband. That we shouldn't really be talking about secondary. Because a lot of the times, physical virgins haven't given themselves over to God yet. They haven't really made a gift of themselves to the Lord yet. Yes, they haven't lost their virginity in a physical sense. But they also have loved. They also have given. And so to focus on this real meaning of woman finding herself
through receiving others' love and giving love in response. So for a woman in that virginal gift of herself to the Lord, she receives the Lord's love first, poured into her heart, in response with a wholehearted gift of herself over to God.
As we would see in Mary, that's how it comes about. Virginity has to be considered, John Paul II would write in his beautiful document on women in 1988, Mulieris Dignitatem, The Dignity of Women. He says, virginity has to be considered also as a path for women, a path in which they realize their womanhood in a way different from marriage. One can't correctly understand virginity, a woman's consecration virginity, for example, without referring to spousal love. It's through this kind of love that a person becomes a gift for the other. Naturally, the spousal predisposition of the feminine personality finds a response in virginity understood in this way. It's through virginity that a woman can give a sincere gift of herself to God who has given himself to her first. Thus, they relate to the divine spouse, and this personal gift leads to union, which is properly spiritual in character.
I'm really concerned about this aspect today because I don't think that we train people how adequately to love the Lord. And we think that we love the Lord by the simple fact that we don't hate him. I was a biochemist at Harvard, and then I taught a lot of bioethics over the course of my priesthood. And early in my priesthood in Massachusetts, I set up this bioethics series for the Knights of Malta, who do an awful lot with medicine, flying people over to Lourdes every year, etc. And for one of these series, the lecturer was coming down from Boston. He was a Jesuit priest at GC or Western School of Theology, I can't remember. Father Vachik was his name. And the lecture was supposed to start at 4:30. At 4:15, he still wasn't there. 4:20, he wasn't there. The knights and the dames were starting to get concerned. 4:25, he wasn't there. They said, Father, can you give his talk if he doesn't come? It's just like totally off the cuff for 90 minutes. Sure, easy. Let's just pray that Father Vachik arrives. 4:35, he's not there. No call. 4:45, still not there. I'm beginning to actually put notes together now for what would be a 60-minute talk rather than a 90-minute talk. 4:55, he comes on in, disheveled and the whole rest of it. So, so sorry. So he comes on up, and I say, without further ado, Father Vachik, I mean, I wasn't going to spend any time with the introduction. He said, I am so sorry. I was coming down 24, he said, from Boston, and there was an accident on the side of the road. Because I'm a priest, I drove up the breakdown lane to see if it were needed. And I got out where I started to get to the cars and things, and I was walking, and I asked the police officer, any need for me? He says, it's probably too late. Do you mind if I go up? So he continues to go up. He starts seeing officers weeping. He sees the jaws of life around the car. And then he looks into the car to see the person in the driver's seat. And he said he was shocked because he recognized the person in the driver's seat. And then he said to everyone, I'm afraid you're all going to know who it was. I hate to be the one to break it to you. But the dead person in that seat was God. Mm-hmm. And he paused. And I was starting to say, too bad he showed up. I had no idea where this guy was going. He said, actually, the reason why I'm late is because I'm a Jesuit and I'm a klutz behind the wheel. But I wanted, the whole talk was about loving God and neighbor and healthcare. He said, I wanted to try to illustrate a point. If as I was going through that entire story, as I'm setting it up, that you know the person in that seat. If I had said that were your bishop or your pastor, if I had said that was your mother or your father or your best friend or your son or your daughter, what would your reaction have been? You would have known right off the bat that your life is now changed forever. He said, but when I said the word God, did you breathe a sigh of relief? thanks be to God, it was the Lord who really can't die. He said, if you did, it might be a sign that your relationship with the Lord is less real, less impactful than your relationship with your husband or your wife or your mom or your dad or your son or your daughter or your best friend or your bishop or your pastor. Now, you might not like the rhetorical device that he used, but it is an important point for us to consider. For example, with our love for God, if we were in love, if a man and a woman loves each other, they're talking pretty much all day long with one for another, texting each other, small little phone call, thinking about each other. Their intentionality is clearly directed toward the other. Do we have a similar one in our relationship with God? When Jesus says, love God with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength, do we think all means 5%, 10%, 12.6% of our strength? Do we really put the effort in to love God with our energy? I'm very pleased that on a Friday night and a Saturday in March, you're here. It's a sign that your relationship with God is important, that you're going to sacrifice other things in order to be here to grow in your relationship with the Lord. But we need to make this ever more practical. I say to couples, if you were to see each other only 1 hour a week, would that be enough for your relationship to really grow? I most sincerely say no, it really wouldn't. But somehow we think that that's effective for a relationship with God. A married couple would never be able to survive just talking to each other for 3 minutes or five before they go to bed. Would be enough to sustain and make a relationship with love grow. Yet somehow in our relationship with God, we're supposed to love even more than a spouse if he's really God in our life. We don't. So when we're talking about this virginal meaning of masculinity and femininity, it's really talking about, have we received God's love and are we giving our love back with priority? Because that's when we're going to become far more manly and far more womanly. Far more capable of the spiritual paternity and spiritual maternity. Because it's God who will be teacher. And God who in that complementarity is going to help us bring that into all our other relationships. When we talk about maternity, we likewise need to talk about spiritual maternity, which can be lived even by those who are not physical moms, just like Saint Joseph lived his spiritual paternity even though he wasn't a physical dad. What does this mean? It means that woman is predisposed to being open to each and every person, that she finds them unique, that her spiritual maternity is always profoundly personal. It's not just motherhood of everybody, it's motherhood of this one and that one and the next. There's a convergence between this spiritual virginity and spiritual maternity. It not only moves from motherhood toward virginity, but from virginity toward marriage. They're mutually complementary, John Paul II would insist. That our love for others is meant to be translated into our love for God. If we care for others with a particular sensitivity, we likewise learn how to care for God in a more practical way. Likewise, once we're capable of a real commitment to God, then we can love our neighbor in that commitment to God. The ultimate dignity of woman comes according to the order of love. That the feminine genius is expressed in the order of love. Drawing forth from people their own divine gifts, helping God ultimately to come alive, drawing life from others. John Paul II wrote in Mulieris Dignitatem, unless we refer to this order of love and the primacy of this order of love, we cannot give a complete and adequate answer to the question about woman's dignity and vocation. When we say, as I said earlier today, that the woman is the one who receives love in order to give love in return, this refers not only, or above all,
to the specific spousal relationship of marriage. It means something far more universal. Based on the very fact of her being woman within all of her interpersonal relationships, which in the most varied way shapes society and structures the interaction between all persons, men and women.
That woman is the professor of love in the school of civilization, is what he's basically saying. That women need to teach the world how to love. Think about Book of Genesis for a second. God's made Adam. He's got all the creation, and he's lonely. He can't receive or reciprocate God's love yet. It wasn't good for him to be alone. Then Eve comes, and he, through her love for him and his coming out of himself to love her, became capable of receiving God's love and loving God back. That he couldn't really adequately exist in a relationship with the love of God until the human analogy of human love helped him to enter into that relationship. So many women religious, for example, in Catholic schools have taught everybody how to love. Nurses or women religious in hospitals taught people to love even through suffering. And that's why radical feminism, and I distinguish that from the authentic feminism, please take that adjective very seriously, has done so much harm, not just to individual women caught up in this conceptual cancer, but also to so much of our society. Because if women are supposed to be the teachers of love, and they start living by the metric of power, fallen male category, they're not only damaged, but all of society is incalculably damaged. There was a movie I saw on a plane going back and forth to Europe a couple months ago. I forget even the title, but it was set here, in which the real thing were women using everything at their disposal in order to get real power and to get rich. And that was the moral of the story. And how sad it was when it was over. Because that's against women and against women's dignity. That's what J.P. Tu is trying to argue.
From the beginning, woman was placed and created by God in this order of love, and her moral and spiritual strength is joined to her awareness that God entrusts others to her in a special way. Of course, he says, God entrusts every human being to each and other, every other human being. But this entrusting concerns women in a special way, precisely by reason of her femininity. And this in a particular way determines her vocation. And she becomes strong because of this awareness of entrusting. One of the greatest examples of courage, greatest icons, is the mama bear. And the mama bear comes because she loves her child. Our time in particular awaits the manifestation of that genius that belongs to every woman and which can ensure sensitivity for human beings in every circumstance because they are human. The greatest of all God's gifts is love, and it's women who receives it and teaches that to the world. For women, her power, John Paul II would say in his letter to women in 1995, woman's principal power is her love. Focusing on Mary, he makes a general point to say, for Mary and for women in general, to reign, R-E-I-G-N, to reign is to serve. That woman finds herself in this unselfish gift of herself to others. In an analogous way to the way man does. Man likewise has to serve, but there's a feminine way, and women get this more easily than guys do. In the vast domain of service, the Church's 2,000-year history, for all its historical conditioning, has truly experienced the genius of woman. From the heart of the Church, there have emerged women of the highest caliber who have left an impressive and beneficial mark in history. Necessary emphasis must be placed on this genius of women, not only by considering the great and famous women of the past or present, but also ordinary women reveal the gift of their womanhood by placing themselves at the service of others in their everyday life. For in giving themselves to others each day, women fulfill their deepest vocation, perhaps more than men. And here's the beautiful line. Perhaps more than men, women acknowledge the person because they see the person with the eyes of the heart. They're not superficial abstractors the way men are, which is why men are attracted to a particular type of pornography that doesn't have to have faces. Whereas women are more attracted to the relational porn, to the emotional porn. But women see with the heart. And that's part of their feminine genius, that they see a lot of the times what guys cannot see. The last part of this that I want to focus on is just a talk that happened 9 days ago at the UN. We had a wonderful event on the dignity of women through her work and trying to show that there doesn't have to be a contradiction between the beautiful work of family, being married and a mother, and professional work. There will be tensions, for sure, balances that need to happen, but there do not need to be straight out irreconcilable conflicts. One of our speakers that day was Dr. Gracie Christie, who's a radiologist from Florida who is a talking head on a lot of Spanish television, but also English-speaking television, cable news. She writes a lot for U.S. World, U.S. News and World Report, USA Today, and other things. She gave an extraordinary talk about merging the feminine genius of a mom with a doctor. I just want to illustrate a little bit of what I'm saying and what she said, because I think it's very accessible. While fully including women as doctors, she said, demands changes in traditional practices, especially if they're still going to have a family. As a whole, it greatly enriches the medical vocation by adding to the medical mix the moral strengths and distinctive aptitudes of one half the population. Also, it goes without saying that reserving the practice of medicine just for men diminishes the dignity of women who have the hunger or feel a calling to be a physician. If I may paraphrase John Paul II, who wrote extensively about the dignity of labor, work is a good thing for women and for men. It's good not only in the sense that it's useful, that it makes something, but that it corresponds to our dignity, expresses it, and helps us to grow in correspondence to it. Through work, we make ourselves, and in a sense, become more human. All of us have this experience of becoming more human through our work. We've also been challenged by the difficulties that come with earning our bread through the sweat of our vows, fatigue, anxiety, and daily contradictions. But we've learned to cooperate generously with others, joining hands and wills in the pursuit of some important goal. All of this growth and development cannot take place in solitude and selfishness. Men, and especially women, are creatures of personal connection who find and grow the noblest parts of themselves in relation to the other. Becoming a person fully alive, fully developed, requires a sincere gift of ourselves to and for others. Living for others' good in service of the other expands our hearts, our character, our capacity, the way living for ourselves alone can never do. Now she gets to medicine. Medicine is almost everywhere acknowledged to be a noble calling. That's because it's a profession that asks from its practitioners a particularly demanding gift of self. I'm not just referring to the long days, the years of training and studying that never end. I'm referring, rather, to the singular intimacy between doctor and patient. The patient turns to the doctor in grave need when pain and haunts and death stalks, when all his or her careful defense and elaborate plans have been blown up by illness and fear, and the patient looks for something needed desperately in his or her doctor's eyes. What are they looking for? They're looking for a sincere gift of self, a compassionate concern that leads to sacrifice and action. Anyone who's been sick and tended a sick loved one knows what I'm talking about. It's a gaze from the heart that promises to accept the patient in all his troubled, exposed, naked humanity, no matter the ugliness or hopelessness of the case or the material situation of the sufferer. It looks upon the patient and sees not symptoms, but a suffering person in need and deserving of tender attention and forbearing solicitude. St. John Paul II, she said, writing about women's dignity, called women's particular and distinctive gifts the feminine genius. He places the origin of that genius squarely in her capacity to be a mom, which he wrote implies from the beginning a special openness to a new person, a process that literally absorbs the energies of her body and soul. He elaborated that both in her heart and in her distinctive biology, she's capable of the most complete gift of self, of accepting and giving birth to new life with all the generosity this demands. And this accepting and loving of the child she carries, she comes into unique contact with the human being developing within her, something that gives rise to an attitude toward all human beings. He forthrightly pointed out the common recognition that women are more capable than men, paying close attention to others, and that motherhood develops this predisposition even more. It is just in this way that women make themselves a gift to the medical profession, enriching and augmenting it by their personal resources of femininity in all our biological capacity and originality. We women can be especially suited to making this sincere gift of self that graces our vocation, especially even in all its practical difficulties when our hearts are enlarged by motherhood. I felt this reality very strongly when I myself became a mother, she said. I changed as a doctor. I was caring for a patient with AIDS, ravaged not just by the disease, but by a hard life in the margins of society. And I recognized more vividly and deeply than ever before that he was a dignified and priceless person, just like my baby son. I learned to cry with mothers and fathers who wept seeing their children in pain and to respond with patience to their endless, panicked questions. The joy of being a mother helped me to understand more profoundly the overwhelming sense of injury and pain a woman who suffered a miscarriage goes through. I learned, in short, really to see the vulnerable, precious, irreplaceable human being in each of my patients. Then she gave the results of the recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the most prestigious medical journals, compared mortality rates of hospital patients, those treated by male physicians and those treated by female physicians. Same illness is everything controlled as it ought to be in any medical study. And it found that for patients in the same hospital with the same diseases, those treated by women doctors had significantly lower death rates compared to those cared for by male doctors. The authors concluded that male and female physicians treat their patients differently, relate to them differently, and that these differences have important clinical implications for patient outcomes. She concluded by it, not that this study proves that women doctors are better. It has to be replicated. But adding the feminine genius to the practice of medicine enriches and enhances it and brings valuable diversity. The patients reap the rewards of a workplace that welcomes and accommodates women. That's why she said one of the real struggles for medical students today is there's such a huge pressure to give up the maternal side of their femininity in order to be a doctor. She says our culture, for the sake of saving our own lives, has got to make far more room for working moms in medicine. It saves lives to have mothers who are doctors. Motherhood, when it comes in her concluding paragraph, will enlarge our hearts and redouble our ability to serve our patients. The hours we spend with our children are not stolen, but instead replenish the energy and enthusiasm we need at work, make us more human, and help us better to care for our fellow human beings. Of course, when we prioritize like this, making room in our busy schedule, reserving time for children's needs and the care of our home, we probably won't be able to grow our incomes or advance our career as many of our male or unmarried or childless co-workers do. But she said the compromise is worth it. It's an application of the feminine genius. And we could look at almost any profession and see the value that's been brought there by this extra special vision for others that comes from the core of one's being and the capacity to nurture almost midwife the best out of those cared for. So as we wrap and go to questions, I'd encourage you to consider these things. First, who are our culture's dominant images of motherhood?
What good do we find in those depictions? And what negative and false stereotypes do we find?
Would you repeat them, please?
What are our culture's predominant images of women?
Motherhood.
Motherhood. And what are the good and the negative aspects of those depictions? Second question. If you are a woman, who has shown you most powerfully what John Paul II calls the feminine genius? Do you feel that you've got this special sensitivity? Or are there obstacles to its expression? For men? What were the ways that you can recall from your own mothers, grandmothers, and female teachers of the twofold dimension of the feminine genius, of the person's capacity for self-giving and a woman's capacity for nurturing and caring for you as a person rather than just as another student? And then lastly, for everybody, in what ways does the church need to promote, form, and celebrate the feminine genius? Okay? Glory to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Mother of the Church,
pray for us.
Saint Gianna Barettamola.
Pray for us.